This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl. My name is Lucy Smith, and I don't know where you're listening from, but for me, the air is getting crisper. It's getting a little bit colder, and one of my favourite things to do is to pull up with a cup of tea, a bicky, we're dipping it in. We had a caller who noticed that the biscuit held more liquid between tea and coffee. Why is that? Do we get to the bottom of it? You'll find out in this week's episode. We also chat about why we make that face when we cry, and also we get the case of earthworms in a pool. Maybe you'll relate to this one. It's all coming up. Let's dive in. Dr. Carl, you mentioned earlier in the year, in fact, I want to say it was a couple of months ago, that you'd been on a mission flossing your teeth. Tell us about it.
90,000 times.
What is going on? How?
Well, the dentist told me when I was saying, what's the story with this plaque? So the bacteria, they live in your mouth, and if you don't keep on getting rid of them, they form this smooth calcium-like plaque on the inside of your teeth and the outside. And I said, I'm sick of it. He says, well, are you dental flossing? But do you know I didn't discover dental flossing until my 20s?
Yeah, I think that's the case for a lot of people.
And also I've found people who for decades have only washed, have brushed only the outside of their teeth facing the lips, not the inside facing the tongue. And
you
I didn't know they had to.
All angles.
Right. And then I myself didn't know I had to do the gums and also at the back, so I've learned a lot about teeth. Anyway, so I brushed each side of each tooth, roughly 30 teeth, so that's 25 teeth, 25 size, whatever. So it's about 10 times up and down, 500 times each night while Mary's going, this is taking a long time, isn't it? Brush, brush, brush. So 500 a night, that's 500,000. That's 15,000 a month for 6 months. 90,000 times have I run dental floss up and down my teeth.
Wow.
Purely on this mission from God or the universe to see if it gets rid of the plaque. And the plaque, according to the dentist whom I saw just the other day, was both much reduced and also the gums were in the best condition you'd ever seen. And
yes,
you know they do that thing where they get the little pointy tool and they sort of shove it down the inside of the gum.
Yeah.
And every now and then you get a bit of blood here and there. He said, and for the first time, there's been no blood. So brushing the teeth, and so there's three sides for your molars, yeah, like the inside, the outside and the top, two sides for your incisors, and then the dental floss, I now have the best teeth ever in my whole life.
Yes, Dr. Carl, you've been on a mission. It's paid off.
But now I've got to keep on doing it. Or can I get lazy?
I know. Maybe you can. No, I think you've got to keep doing it. I think you've locked in now.
Yeah. Well, it has been claimed that the time needed to establish a habit is 21 days.
Mm.
And this is from a misreading of a paper back in the early 90s. And I was immediately suspicious by the 21 because there's two numbers that appear often when people make false claims. There's 7 and 3. You know,
aww,
like your calcium atoms are replaced every 7 days or weeks or years. And and 3, well, there's 3 days of the week, according to the country and Western singers, yesterday, today and tomorrow, and each one worse than the one before it. So you put them together, you get 21. And it turns out that the average time to build up a habit and make it automatic is 66 days, but it varies from 21 to 280 days, depending on the person.
Really?
And you just got to do it and make it automatic and have low friction. So with regard to going to the gym, I suddenly realized there's this whole thing where, for most people, you have to get your clothes on and then get a gym membership and then shift your body to the gym. And I was thinking of the Pilates yoga type style where you just use your own body weight and a mat, and that's got very low friction. You can just say, I'll do it now.
Mm.
And so there we are. We're giving moral messages of
advice.
We've
had a lot of PSAs just in
Sorry.
The first couple of minutes.
Let's stick to science. Come on.
No.
Sorry.
It's all a part of the journey of science with Dr. Carl, which we are about to go on. Reese in Melbourne,
Dr. Reese, welcome.
Are kicking us off. What do you want to know?
Hi, doctors. I would like to know, is it true a pelican can have a sleep while flying?
Some creatures can put to sleep half their brain, and dolphins can do that. And one part of their brain goes totally to sleep, and they swim in the middle of the pack in such a way that they're looking at other dolphins swimming in that pack or pod, not looking at the outside world. because otherwise they could drift off. So the half that's awake is just following what the other dolphins do. Pelicans can do it to a minor degree, but they don't go into a total sleep, and they do that hemispheric one side of the brain or the other. There are some birds that do a lot of gliding, and I think that the albatross can stay on the wing for literally months.
Wow.
And so apparently they can do this thing. And how do we know? We've got these incredibly lightweight sensors and radio transmitters where we can monitor stuff. Like in your phone, you've got 5 radio transmitters, each one about the size of a head of a pin. And I remember when in Physics 101, I built a radio receiver transmitter. It was the size of a microwave.
Wow.
You know, and now they're the size of a pin and you've got 5 of them.
Tiny.
So that's how they find this stuff out. You got another question, Dr. Rees?
I was just going to ask, if they did fall asleep while they were flying, how did they know where they were going?
They've got various navigation methods. So they've set themselves up to go with or against the wind. And according to Jim Al-Ail Khalili, K-H-A-L-I-L-I, in his book Quantum Life, they've got little tiny nanoparticles of iron that act in a quantum fashion to pick up the Earth's magnetic field. My God. Wow.
Okay.
Whereas you and I, we need a compass or a smartphone.
Hmm.
Simple as that.
Reese, thanks for your question.
No, thank you. Thanks, Liz.
All right, we got Giuliano in Cairns. Now, Giuliano, we've talked about hearing protection a lot on the show. What's your question?
Hey, g'day, doctors. So my question is, I understand obviously hearing protection is important at festivals and concerts and loud music events, but I was driving with my windows down the other day and I noticed that it's pretty loud that I have to turn the radio way up. But I couldn't hear the radio properly anyway. Is that still damaging your ears or that wind in your ears?
Yes. The trouble is it's going to cost you a couple of dollars to find out, about as much as a cup of coffee. So what you do is you go online onto Wikipedia and it gives you a table of how long you can have the sound level at a certain level before you cause damage. And so with regard to standing next to a jet engine on takeoff, you've damaged your ears forever, instantly. And then it can be 5 minutes, an hour, several hours, and you look up that table. Then you go online and you order one of these apps where you use the microphone in your smartphone, and they give the cheap version, the free one, doesn't give you enough info, so you have to fork out a whole cup of coffee, and then that'll tell you what your dB level is. And then you put the two of them together. I'm getting 80 dB for 2 hours. That's bad for my hearing. I don't want to go deaf. So that'll get you started on that pathway.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Giuliano. We got Jared. Now, Jared, you were one of the first people to text in today. What's your question?
Mr. Carl, Dr. Carl, how are you doing today, mate? Just a quick one for you. What is it called when the two rivers meet to a body of water?
They use this word also in anatomy. It's called a confluence. And so we have the Murray-Darling River, which is the big system in Australia, having a confluence somewhere on the border of New South Wales and Victoria, I think, and then the Murrumbidgee and the Murray. And then each of the states has a bunch of rivers with their own confluences. We are an incredibly dry continent. We're the driest inhabited continent on Earth. And the reason for that is that we do not have enough mountains in a single chain. So the USA has got, which is roughly the same size as Australia, the contiguous or touching states, they have mountain ranges on the left and the right. And so the wind comes in from the ocean, hits the mountain range, rises up, drops its water, and so you've got rain both sides of mountain range. In Australia, we've got only one mountain range, the Great Dividing Range, which when Europeans come here, they say, mate, it's bloody mediocre. It's just the mediocre or average dividing range. It's not great.
Mm-hmm.
It's just average.
Yeah, how interesting. Do you remember how you remembered that or where you learnt it from?
Yes. About 2 decades, I saw this book in a shop called, it was something about building another mountain range on the border of Western Australia and Northern Territory and South Australia to change the weather patterns in Australia. And the guy had worked out the numbers and said that for a reasonable percentage of Australia's annual GDP, we could actually build a mountain range and then change the weather patterns in Australia. And so we'd be lush in the middle of Australia other than elsewhere.
Thanks, Jared. If you have a question, 0439 757 555 is the number to text it in. Courtney on the Gold Coast saying, not flossing between your teeth is like not washing between your butt crack. What do you think of that?
It's an interesting metaphor. But Actually, I did follow the dentist as they did their work, and I had very little plaque on the left and right side of each tooth,
mm-hmm.
but I had a bit on the front and the back, and that would then mean I'd have to double the amount of strokes and so have the dental floss going around the back of my teeth for 10 strokes up and down, and then around the front of my teeth, which means I'd have to have both my fingers inside my mouth.
Which could be even more unsanitary than anything.
Yeah, but it's like my... I've got to a level where the dentist loves my gums, so I'm very happy.
And they love your love you going to the dentist so much, frankly.
Yeah. it's weird. I remember way back when I was a very junior doctor, I was admitting this 92-year-old woman who had perfect teeth. And I said, man, how come your teeth are so good? And she said, ever since I was about 5, I followed my mother's advice to use a bit of silk between my teeth. And so she had done the dental flossing herself from, you know, like 5 or so. And
oh
she
my
had
God,
every
she
single
was
one
on
of her
that.
Teeth. Yeah, she was way ahead of the curve.
Matt in Shoalhaven Heads, talk to us. So you've been watching the racing, right?
Yeah, really into cycle racing and watching the Giro d'Italia. And they keep breaking records because they are such amazing humans. And so it's kind of like a biology and social science question for Dr. Carl in terms of they are so amazing in terms of their abilities, yet we seem to go more crazy for things like soccer.
So this one's a little bit of a, I guess, a culture question as much as it is, you know, is there a scientific element, Matt, that you want to talk about?
Well, the human performance of these cycling athletes to be able to ride for 3 weeks at an average of 50 kilometres an hour is pretty amazing. Yet we tend to focus on people who play a sport that lasts for 90 minutes or gack out the amazing performance of 20 seconds in the 200 metres the other week.
So I guess, yeah, Dr. Carl, what does that say from an audience perspective, that that's the thing that gets the most attention or, you know, any
There's
thoughts?
Psychology there and time. So if you look at the word news, which, you know, tells you about the world, 3 of those 4 letters in that word are new. And so building a bridge, which is a wonderful thing, which would take years, doesn't make the news in the same way as the falling down of the bridge. And that short, a lot of activity in a short time is what attracts the human attention. So with soccer or football, but that's his real name, you've got this universal, short, dramatic and highly energetic activity with goals that last for a second or so. Whereas with the cycling, you're looking at it like a long-term strategy. It's not as theatrically as obvious, and they've built up what they're able to do over a long period of time, like the footballers, but also they deliver it over a long period of time. And if you look at them doing it now, and then you look at them in 10 minutes and an hour, and the next day, it looks still the same. So you don't get that quite that sudden change, that sudden impact, that big leap in change that attracts the human attention. We tend to respond better to things that change rapidly. If you're a psychologist, please ring in on 0439 757 555.
He did it.
Oh, I'm so good.
Matt, thanks for your question. And thanks for, you know, reminding us all of what we can also be directing our attention to.
No dramas.
Yay. We've got Carly in Gladstone here. Dr. Carly, what's your question?
Hi. I'm just wondering, why do we make that face when we cry?
There's a few reasons. Some of them are anatomical. So when you cry, you're producing tears from mainly from the glands, the tear glands in the upper outer corner of each eye. So you've got 3 sets of tear glands, but the one that gives you the bulk, the volume, is in the upper outer corner of each eye. And when you're doing that, the eyes water, the eyelids will close a little. So straight away you're looking like you're squinting. You've then got muscular tension involved, and you'll drop your face into some version of the RBF or the resting bitch face. And then you've got your furrows, you know, narrowing up and the mouth trembling and dropping, and all of these associated with big emotion.
And, you know, you're kind of crying and you're just like, ugh. But then also there can be moments, Dr. Carl, when, you know, tears are falling, but we aren't making that thing with our face. Why is that?
That's a mystery as to why we cry sometimes with happiness.
Mm.
You're laughing so much, and I'm guessing it's some sort of involvement. Now, this is where my knowledge of the neuroanatomical innervation of the lacrimal glands with regard to emotion is deficient. I failed you on that one.
But
I'm reckoning that is part of it, that you are, for some reason, activating them, and I don't know why.
Thanks for your question, Carly.
Thank you.
Wow, thank you so much.
We've got Justin in Newcastle. Justin, you got a question about one of my favourite activities. Justin, what do you want to know?
Oh, yes, I've got a very exciting question about tea and coffee.
Yes.
So I was wondering, what I've done is I've dunked biscuits in both tea and coffee, and it doesn't seem to absorb the coffee as much. It doesn't seem to go as soggy. And I've tried it with different biscuits that have chocolate on them, don't have chocolate on them, dry, that sort of thing. And the coffee I'm drinking is also very similar, like a long black with milk in it or tea with milk in it. So I can't quite figure out why they don't go as soft.
You've already captured my next question, which was going to be, is it just simply that there's more water in tea? But if you're drinking the long blacks and that's also got the same amount of water content. Interesting. Dr. Carl, any thoughts?
So let me get this straight. So what sort of biscuits are you doing the dunking with?
So I've tried it with different ones.
Yep.
So the kind that, you know, you can snap in half that are quite dry.
Oh, the longitudinal ones. I love breaking them into two halves so that way you get twice as many opportunities to dunk. Yeah, keep going.
And there's that variation with chocolate on the bottom, which I've tried. And
the oval ones, which have got no sweet stuff on them at all.
No, I haven't tried the oval ones, but I have tried the oval ones that are like a sandwich.
Now, this is a deep topic that you're getting into. Now, you're saying that the tea causes the biscuit to absorb more liquid.
Well, yeah, it seems to go softer. So it's softer in the mouth. I don't have a measure of softness.
Like, you are so close, mate. Okay, so firstly, the person who actually won an Ig Nobel Prize on this is Len Fisher.
Wow.
And he did a lot of research on tea dunking, as I did myself in Why Belly Button Fluff is Blue and all that sort of stuff. So he found that the optimal biscuit is the ginger hard biscuit, where one side is curved and hard and stiff, and the inside is that soft stuff. And that way you slide it, not vertically. Oh, no. He actually did measurements with numbers and everything. You slide in at an angle, and that little cavity will have enough structural integrity to take the weight of the liquid and not have the biscuit break into little bits falling to the bottom of the cup. So that's the pathway he went down. Now, I'm suggesting that for you, you know, we're giving you a job here for which you'll win a Triple J fun pack if you have lots of writing.
Well, I've also tried it with the chocolate ones that are covered in chocolate and you bite the corners off and suck the tea through.
Yep.
Tried it with those. It just doesn't get the same melted squishiness with coffee.
Now, you know what the Mythbuster said, difference between science and screwing around is writing it down. And unfortunately, you're going to need a kitchen scale. They're pretty accurate. They'll give you like two fractions of a gram. So measure the biscuits before and after and do this over a period of weeks and try to get some friends involved and get some numbers and then get back to us.
Okay. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get friends to measure their biscuits, unfortunately.
You know, you and I are in a small minority of people who would do that. I'll talk to you another time about flossing your teeth 90,000 times. If you can get a weighing scale, measure the biscuits, and then have it on paper that, oh, my God, there is. And the point that you made about having a coffee that was similar in consistency to the tea, in other words, a majority of water and less milk, that was very clever of you there.
Yeah.
Good on you, Justin.
Well, that's just how I like to drink my coffee, but
okay,
it's just a coincidence, really.
Yeah. Okay, so get the measuring scales, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks or a month or two.
And Justin, Darren has texted in saying, Mr. Biscuit is on point, so you've now got a nickname as well.
Mr. Biscuit.
Mr.
Oh, my
Biscuit.
God, you didn't even do a social media post on this and become famous.
Yes, Mr. Biscuit. Thanks, Justin.
Well, maybe I will be able to find some friends to measure their biscuits with me.
I think you will, honestly. God, I love dipping a bicky into a cuppa.
It's heaven-like.
So good. Now, Susie in the Pilbara, what do you want to know? You've got a question about your water bottle.
Yeah, hi, doctors. I just wanted to know, if you've got a water bottle that you're carrying and it feels really heavy, like, and you drink the water, like, is your load then lighter? Like, I just wondered if the net effect is that you actually have less to carry if you drink the water or if you were to tip it out.
Short answer, the weight measured on the scales, if you're standing on scales, is the same, but it's better distributed. But just before we dive into it, so you're in the Pilbara up in that top left-hand corner of Australia where I believe they have the world record for the world's longest train of 8 kilometres?
Yeah. I work on the iron ore mine, so yes, that's correct.
And they did have the world's longest train. They did it for the record.
Yeah.
Wow. And they could do that thing that's been done with horses where they can get energy for free. So they're loaded with iron ore. They go downhill for free just using electric motors running backwards to catch the energy, and they can go back uphill again for free, but they haven't moved to that thing. Okay, to answer your question, so the number you've got, water is molecules of H2O. They don't just vanish suddenly when you drink them. They're just redistributed from the container where you're holding it, maybe a kilo or half a kilo, awkwardly in one hand while you're trying to do something else, into your body, and very quickly from your stomach is then redistributed into your bloodstream and evenly over your whole body. So the weight of your, as measured at your feet, is the same, but it's better distributed. So you don't feel as though you're carrying this weight. You're only carrying just a little bit spread through your whole body. And that can be a problem for some people where if in later years they put on a little bit of weight, and I don't mean just a little bit, I mean like 20 kilos, carrying a 20 kilo backpack is hard. And you notice it straight away. But if it's distributed over your whole body, you can then end up setting yourself up for later diseases. But getting back to your question, have I answered your question, which is that the weight is still the same, it's just easily better distributed so you don't feel it?
Yeah, that definitely answers the question because, as you know, it's very hot over here. So, like, sure. I don't want to pour it out. I think I'll just drink it and then it'll feel lighter.
And what do you do up there in the mines? You're not a train driver, are you?
No, I'm a construction labourer, so I work outside a lot. That's why I'm always carrying water.
Wow. And how much water would you go through?
It depends. Like this time of year, it's really nice temperature, so not so much, maybe 3 litres a day. But in the summer, 5 to 6 litres.
Wow.
And
what,
I'm only a little person. Well, yeah.
And is the Pilbara the place where there are traffic lights in the ocean, in the sea, for the ships to come in and out on? I remember seeing that in one part of Western Australia when I was travelling up there.
Yeah, but traffic lights nowhere else, not on the roads.
Is that weird? Traffic lights in the ocean,
in the sea,
but not on the roads.
That's wild.
It's a different world.
Susie, thanks for taking us there. Appreciate your question.
Thanks so much.
Yay, we've got Annabelle in Sydney. Dr. Annabelle, what do you want to know?
Hi, I'm curious why my radio gets quieter when I go through some tunnels in Sydney. It doesn't get staticky, it doesn't like disconnect, it just, the volume goes down.
Mm.
Oh.
And is it also why my maps lose their mind as well?
Oh, that's so annoying when you're going through a tunnel as well.
So I mentioned earlier that you've got these little radios in your phone and there's a special radio for picking up the signal from the GPS satellites. And that's not going to go in a tunnel. But in the cars, they've got different degrees of smarts and they've also got gyroscopes that measure whether you're turning left or right and speeding up and slowing down. And so they'll estimate where you would be and they know what the tunnel is. And so in some cases, they just say, no, I'm not picking up anything. But if the car's got a few more smarts, it'll say, you're here, but it's not actually measuring it from the satellites, is just estimating it. That's the first thing. The second thing is that with the radio, you didn't generally lose radio in the tunnels, but in some of the tunnels, they've got retransmitters, which work on some, but not all of the stations. So they'll work on the government stations, and they've got their own special channel which can come across all of those. The reason they do that is so they can come across your radio, if you happen to be listening to the radio, and say there's a blockage in lane, the right-hand lane or the left-hand lane. And so the volume that they're retransmitting to you is not the same as you're getting through the air from the antenna outside, I think. Can we have an engineer involved in this with the radio signals to tell me if I'm guessing on the right track? That was all a guess, Dr. Annabelle. But I've noticed the same thing myself and I've talked to people about it and I think that's the right answer, but I'm not sure.
Okay. If we can have a follow-up, 0439 757 555. Thanks, Annabelle, and I hope you're not going into any tunnels in the next 20 minutes, you know? Hope you're not going to miss any signs of Dr. Carl. Up. Thank goodness. All right, Laura in Adelaide. Dr. Laura, what's going on with these earthworms?
Hello. So we installed a in-ground pool about 18 months ago. So it's also got a spa in the corner. So the pool and the spa are at the same level. And I've noticed over the last two summers that often in the morning there'll be a couple of earthworms in the bottom of the pool. But 2 weeks ago in Adelaide, there was a pretty big lightning storm. And the next morning in the bottom of the pool, it was a bit of a mass casualty event. There was probably thousands of earthworms and bloodworms.
Whoa.
Across the bottom of the pool. And I also noted there was none in the spa, which would have been probably 5 degrees warmer. So I'm wondering why all the earthworms tried to go swimming in the lightning.
Is that pool of yours, is it proud of the landscape? Is it the highest point? Or is it in a bit of a dip where water can run across the soil and then, if there's a massive storm, overflow into the pool?
It's at ground level, which is in line with the grass.
Right.
So there's no overflow, no.
Oh, okay. Because that sort of thing that you've described normally happens when you have a massive thunderstorm. And the worms like to breathe air. They are oxygen-breathing creatures. And if the ground is flooded, they'll come to the surface and then you'll see the birds going peck, peck, peck. But in this case, they're on the surface and then depending on the natural flow of the geometry of the ground, they'll either get washed towards or away from the pool or just totally neutral. But you're saying there's no slope on the land that would tend to wash them downhill into your pool?
No.
Right. So I'm guessing in that case, it was just all flooded evenly and there were little currents that carried them across into the pool. Probably not thousands, probably hundreds, but you know it'd be a large number. I'm not too sure why they didn't go into the spa. The spa, as you mentioned, is at a different temperature, but worms don't swim. They're being carried passively by the current, and that's why they're dead at the bottom of the pool.
Oh.
And you'd think that they'd still get carried into the spa unless there was some local geometry that meant that they got picked up by the bigger pool first before the spa, or maybe a bit of a boundary. The way to stop this in the future is to put a little mesh around the edge, but then that's tricky and you trip over it and all that sort of stuff. So I don't know. I think we need a pool mechanic because they know that sort of stuff. Yeah, because the way you find out about things is where they go wrong. And so with regard to motor vehicles, I used to love reading a column called Dirty Wheels, which was by mechanics. And there you read the real stuff, not what the marketing people tell you.
Mm.
So any pool mechanics, please ring in with your knowledge and help take Laura out of this dreaded invasion of the earthworms every time there's a major rainfall.
Yeah, what's the deal with the worms? Laura, thanks for ringing in.
Thank you, Dr. Laura.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Some other people texting in saying we also got a heap of worms in the pool after a rain event. Very interesting. We had a question about all these worms going into the pool.
Mm.
Okay, so a couple of people have texted in. Someone saying the pool has a valve in the bottom to let groundwater in to stop the shell floating out of the water. Worms come through the valve.
Hang on, say that sentence again. The pool has a valve?
I don't know if maybe they've made an error, but the pool has a valve in the bottom to let groundwater in to stop the shell floating out of the water. Worms come through the valve.
Oh, you can have that thing where the empty shell, imagine you've dug a hole in the ground and it's a good fit for the pool, then you drop in the fiberglass pool and then it can be lifted up by the groundwater.
Oh.
Now, that is a whole range of discussion that we need our pool mechanic to educate us on further.
Someone's saying, if there's a lot of rain, many animals, including toads and worms, can't differentiate between land and water and often accidentally end up in pools.
Yeah, if I was a worm and drowning in one part of the countryside, I'd try and go somewhere else, not knowing whether it'd be better, but at least I wouldn't drown there. Yep.
Right now, Zara on the Central Coast. Dr. Zara, what's your question?
Zara, Dr. Zara, you rock. Welcome.
Hi, guys. I was just wondering, how did we figure out the gravitational pull for other planets if we've never actually been there?
It began several thousand years ago with various cultures around the world, ranging from Europe all the way across to China and down into Africa, looking at the stars at night and noticing that those little objects in the sky, some of them moved and but most of them did not. And then they started doing measurements with observatories where they'd have a bunch of sticks in the ground or a building, and these are open-air astronomical observatories, but with no telescopes as such. And they just sort of have these two sticks and line them up and say, oh, that thing's moved over there, now it's moved back again. And then that body of knowledge began to accumulate more and more. And by the time you get to the 1600s in Europe, we've worked out that if you get some glass or two bits of glass, you can make a telescope and make much more accurate measurements. So we started getting numbers coming back. And then around 1666, 65, a couple of things happened in the United Kingdom. The Great Plague came through Europe, which killed about one-third of everybody, and there was a Great Fire of London. And Isaac Newton, who was one of the great mega brains, was stuck on his farm just trying to keep alive. And he was thinking about things, and he came up with his law of gravity. And it's a remarkably simple equation. It's not 100% correct. Einstein had to do a few modifications to it, but not many. But it was, and from that, and the formula is that the force between two objects of a certain mass is G, which is a gravitational constant, M1 multiplied by M2, so the mass of, say, the Sun, the mass of the Earth, divided by their distance squared. And that remarkably simple formula, if you then go and apply it through to the different planets one at a time in the solar system and then the different moons, everything works out. So it comes from Newton and his law of gravitation, and then Einstein had to come and do a modification in 1915. Does that kind of get you started, how we worked it out-ish?
Mm. Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, so the definition of a genius is that they're the sort of person who can look at something that the rest of us look at and they see something different.
Mm.
So Einstein looks down a microscope and then realizes that atoms have to exist. So there are these people who are just incredibly different from us, and I love them to pieces. And Newton was one of those.
Thanks, Zara.
Wow, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Zara.
We got Lucas. Dr. Lucas in Queensland, what's your question?
I just wondered, when you have to burp and like when you have to fart, how does your body decide which one to do? So,
It's geometry. You've got about 10 metres of gut ranging from your mouth, the esophagus, the stomach, the small intestine, the large intestine, and then out into the world. And with burping, it's mainly due to gas that you swallow. And so my little daughter Lola, she suffers from a rare disease called aburpia, where she can't burp. And so she can't have fizzy drinks because it causes gut discomfort. So if you've swallowed some gas or swallowed some air, typically while eating an apple, the gas is in the upper part of your gut, and so it'll just come out as a burp. But then with the fart gases, they're coming from the bacteria at the other end in your large intestine. These bacteria are absolutely essential for your well-being. If you did not have those bacteria, you would have two breakfasts, two lunches, two dinners, and you'd be two-thirds of your body weight, even though you're eating a lot more, and because they give you extra nutrition, and your brain would not be fully developed because they make free fatty acids, and they do all these good things, and they also generate gases.
Mm.
And because they're physically closer to the other end, that's why they come out the other end. Is that kind of answering your question, Lucas?
Or yeah, no, that's good. No, that's good. I'll keep that in mind.
Average person, but 14 times a day, total volume 1.5 litres.
Tara in Brisbane. Dr. Tara, tell us about your dog.
Dr.
What's
Tara.
Going on?
I love the smell of my dog's breath. Mm. And I know that it's not a good smell, but I love it. And I just honestly can't get enough. Why?
Have you had other members?
I'm really outing myself.
Okay,
yeah.
That's okay. Be honest. So have you had other members of your family or friends just check out the smell and they say, oh, my God, Tara, you're right. It smells like roses on a spring morning. Have they said that?
No,
it's going the other way.
They definitely think it stinks. Yeah.
Ah, well, what's those three words? Love is blind? Is this what's going on here?
It could be.
But there could, in fact, be that there's a mix between you and the dog that you have adjusted to each other.
But is it similar to liking the smell of your own farts, maybe?
That's interesting, isn't it?
Mm.
Why does one's own farts normally smell okay but others not?
Mm. Because I wonder,
very true.
You know, Tara, are there other dogs in your life that you are like, oh, God, like, can't handle the smell of their breath?
Yeah, I can't stand the smell of any other dog's breath, but my dog's breath, I love.
I think it's love.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
Love conquers all.
What's your dog's name, Tara?
Her name's Bluebell.
Oh, Bluebell. So cute. And what type of dog?
She's a big, stinky Great Dane.
Great Dane, like a small horse.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Man, how much do you have to feed that thing?
Honestly, not much. She goes through like maybe 20 kilos every 5 weeks of food.
Wow.
So it's just, she doesn't eat as much as people think. Great Dane sleep all the time.
And she's friendly to you and loves you?
Yeah, we're really close. So maybe I'm just in love with the smell of her.
I think you
What's wrong with love?
It's like when people say that they love their boyfriend's body odour.
Yeah.
Happy with the BO. They love it, in fact. We've got Jared in Kendall. Now, Jared, what's going on? You've got some eczema. What's the sitch?
Yeah, I get eczema a lot. And I just wanted to know, why is it that I get it more down my right-hand side of the body, like my face, legs, arms, whatnot?
And you're just finding it's on the right side?
Yeah, like more than the left.
Wow.
There's a small chance that it could be due to a genetic change or metabolic difference between one side of your body and the other. Most people are fairly symmetrical, and if you look at people who are the famous models, etc., they tend to be more symmetrical. I have met people who are noticeably asymmetrical. It is possible that you have a metabolic or physiological difference from one side of the body to the other. It's more likely that it's due to your lifestyle. So the classic case was of a truck driver who always did the same run and had sunlight on their face going out to the job in the morning and coming back in the afternoon. And after about six years, even though ultraviolet is mostly blocked by glass, enough got through that one side of his face was very different from the other side. So do you tend to sleep on one side? Do you tend to favour one side? So I'm thinking that there may be environmental factors.
Right.
But on the other hand, I'm not an expert in this area. For your eczema, do you see a dermatologist every now and then?
I have done, but it's just, you just go back to square one, really.
Okay,
yeah.
And are you in love with sorbolene and glycerin like I am? Besides flossing my teeth, I'm in love with that thing as well. Do you use that stuff?
Oh, I tried it, yeah.
What do you mean you tried it? You mean you don't now?
No, if I get in bed and I'm too tired, then...
No, but hang on, do you wash your body with soap or sorbolene? Putting you on
the
spot here,
the
man.
Body wash, my missus got me.
No. Sorbolene and glycerine, man. It's really cheap. There's a whole bunch of varieties. Pick a nice one that's got the right consistency. Some people like it soft and squishy. I prefer it a little bit firmer, so I get it from the tub. And you wash your body with this, not soap, not body wash. Mm-hmm. Use sorbolene. Talk to your GP about it. I started doing this after I did a term in dermatology in the kids' hospital, and there'd be kids who'd come in bright red as though they'd been sprayed with red paint, and we put on sorbolene and glycerin for a couple of weeks, and it'd make it go away. So try the sorbolene and glycerin. Wash with it.
Let us know how you go, Jared. And we've got Patina in Loxley, Victoria. Patina, what's your question?
Doctor. I was making my toast this morning. And butter and Vegemite on my toast, and my butter melted on my toast, and I thought, okay, what's it going to do? My outside body temperature is like, between 36 and 37, say. What's my inside temperature? Is that butter going to continue to melt in my tummy?
It normally melts at a higher temperature, so the skin temperature is anything from 15 and up to 30 degrees C or a bit higher. Your core temperature is 37, and you need that difference in temperature so the heat energy can travel from a higher temperature to a lower temperature and then to the outside world. I had an experience once when I was having this chocolate that melted on my tongue, and I'd done some laps of the ocean pool, and I came back, and my daughter gave me a cup of coffee, and the chocolate that normally melted on my tongue. Now, I'd been in a pool for about 3/4 of an hour, and the chocolate which normally melted on my tongue would not. My core temperature had dropped from 37 to 36.
Wow.
So your core temperature is normally very constant unless you're hypothermic, cold water, or you're having a fever. So you need that difference in temperature from the inside to the outside so that heat will go down that temperature gradient.
So the butter would continue to melt?
The butter would, I'm going to have to look up the melting point of butter.
Okay.
Okay,
you've got
you've
homework.
Given me homework here. And look, thank you so much, Dr. Patina, writing it down.
Thanks, Patina. We'll see what we can do.
Thank you, doctors.
Thank you.
All right. You can listen back to this via the Science with Dr. Carl podcast. Wherever you get your podcasts, we'll have another episode for you next week. Dr. Carl, I can't wait.
Peace you keen.
And that's it. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. Maybe you already have a question. You already have a follow-up to this week's episode. If you want to send it through, you can do so right now. Just scroll to the show notes. You'll find a Google form there where you can tell us who you are, where you're from, and what your question is for Dr. Carl. Please leave your number so we can give you a call as well, because we want you on the show. We want you a part of history that lives on the podcast forever. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan. I'm Lucy Smith. Sam Lane will be filling in for me next week, but I'll catch you in a fortnight. Either way, please subscribe so you're the first to know when the next episode drops. All right, have a good week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack Podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.